Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on BBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. And by the Rockstar Chronicles Series 1. That's my new book, featuring over 45 intimate conversations with the greatest music legends the world will ever know. Available now at BookBaby.com and Amazon.com. Rick Wills is a British-based guitarist. He is best known for his work with the rock band Foreigner and his associations with the Small Faces, Peter Frampton, and Bad Company. Wills joined the rock band Joker's Wild in 1966 with David Gilmour on guitars and vocals until they broke up in 1968. He played bass on Peter Frampton's first three albums before parting from Frampton in 75. He became the bassist with Roxy Music in 1976 before leaving them and joining the Small Faces in 1977. During that reunion period, he left the Small Faces and appeared on David Gilmour's critically acclaimed solo LP in 1978 with William Wilson on drums. The next year, Wills became a member of rock band Foreigner and remained with them for 14 years. After leaving Foreigner in 1992, he joins Bad Company and stayed there until Boz Burrell rejoined the band in 1998. In July of 1999, he filled in for Leonard Skinner bassist Leon Wilkerson for live shows when Wilkerson briefly took ill. He appeared at the Steve Marriott Memorial Concert on the 24th of April in 2001 as part of a backing band with Bobby Tench, Zach Starkey, and Rabbit Bundrick. Wills was reunited with Small Faces drummer Kenny Jones in the Jones Gang during 2006 and appeared with the RD Crusaders for the Teenage Cancer Trust at the London International Music Show on the 15th of June of 2008. Wills left the Jones Gang in the summer of 2005 and was replaced by Pat Davey. Rick co-wrote the songs Do You Feel Like We Do and Doobie Wah during his time with Peter Frampton. To date, Rick Wills has played bass guitar on 113 published albums and singles. Please welcome legendary bass guitarist Rick Wills to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Ray. How you doing?
I'm doing good, man. You know, you are a walking classic rock music anthology.
Well, you know, if I'd have thought about this when I was like 12, 13 years old starting out on guitar, I would never have dreamt I could have done all those things. It's just been amazing. I've been so lucky to work with some of the very best musicians in the world, and it's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, not many people can say they played with that many bands, you know, and made a difference.
I know. It just worked out that way. As one door would close, another one would open, I guess, and that's how it's been throughout my life, and it's been very interesting, I must say.
Well, it's incredible. You've had a great career. What's going on nowadays? What are you retired? Are you still working in the studio? What are you doing?
Well, no, what we were doing is when Foreigner go out on tour, the current band with Kelly Hansen fronting,
right?
I and Al Greenwood and Mick Jones would, you know, turn up at certain shows and play with the band,
right?
Usually just sort of end the show with them. And it was really working well until this COVID-19 came along and just a whole thing, you know. So we just had to go home and sit on our hands, as it were. But I still play. I mean, I play at home quite a lot, and my son's very active in the songwriting department, and we talk, and we're also, cause, you know, we're actually working on a book right now of my life, so we're doing things at home to stay safe.
Have you kept notes all these years, and do you have pictures for the book?
I have a lot of pictures.
Good.
I don't have all the stuff I would need, and
right.
I will need some help from family members like my sister and
right.
to really sort of tell me where it all started. Because obviously the first 3 or 4 years of your life, it's just, you don't remember it really, because you're just a baby and you're a kid and you're growing up. And, you know, I was born in Somerset in the UK,
mm-hmm.
and all I remember is that we moved an awful lot. My father, he was a carpenter and joiner, and he just worked on estates and for different farms and stuff, and we seemed to move an awful lot. I just seem to remember removal lorries and stuff turning up all the time and just moving house, and it was kind of sort of unsettling in some ways, until we eventually moved to Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 1960 when I was 12, 13 years old. I was born in 47, so I'm 72 now.
Right.
And you know, that's when really things just started to happen, because I was just crazy about guitars. I used to draw them on everything I could get my hands on, and then I pestered my mother so much that I wanted a guitar, because I loved some of the records I'd heard on the radio by Lonnie Donegan, and
mm-hmm.
then The Shadows came along,
yeah.
people like that who were Cliff Richard's backing group. And I just knew there was something there that I had to do, and I was just driven. I mean, school and stuff didn't really do much for me. I went and did what I had to do, but couldn't wait to leave. And then I discovered that not far from where I was living in Cambridge, there was a guy called David Gilmour, and he was a year or two older than me,
mm-hmm.
but he was also really keen and crazy about music too, and we both ended up in local bands before we ended up actually working together, because we both had a dream, I think, you know, to try and make it in this world, as they say, you know, which we eventually did in 66. We moved out of Cambridge, went to London, and just sort of hung out in people's flats and, you know, just tried to get somewhere. And David was being recognized because of, I guess, his looks for some reason. His
yeah.
guitar playing was excellent.
Yeah.
He had a great voice.
Right.
And different people from different sort of companies were very interested. Brian Epstein was interested, obviously the Beatles manager,
mm-hmm.
Andrew Oldham. And, you know, the only kind of worrying thing, I think, for David was there was a very gay scene there, and he wasn't too keen on that. So they decided to pack us off to Spain in 1966 to try and get our act together, as they say. You know? So that's how it all really began to really change over into a more professional way of doing things, apart from being in, you know, the local bands we've been in Cambridge, which were good, but we knew that the guys in those bands weren't really going to really carry it through, as it were. You know, you have to really be passionate about this to do it, because it can
sure.
be awfully tough at first. I mean, it can be heartbreaking, in fact, at times, you know, when you can just go up and down motorways and roads doing gig after gig, and it doesn't ever really seem to get very far, but, you know, you just got to keep going, I guess. You just can't give up, and I never did.
You know what? You guys were lucky in, I guess, because the UK wasn't a large, large country. All the musicians live kind of close to each other. I talked to Jim McCarty, you know, from the Yardbirds,
yeah.
and he was telling me how close Clapton and Beck and Page lived close to each other, you
well,
know?
Yeah, because they were so competitive back then. That was the wonderful thing about the English music scene. It was kind of small compared to the American scene, and we'd learned so much from all the American artists that we'd been listening to, and there was this explosion of talent
mm-hmm.
after all those dreary dark years after the Second World War through the 50s, where everything seemed up against you, you know, everything
yeah.
was hard, and people were rebuilding the country, and for the youth of that time, the teenagers, it was like a time to be really rebellious and to
mm-hmm.
do something different, and that's exactly what they did. Now, when bands like the Yardbirds, the Who, the Small Faces, those bands came out, it was just incredible. The Beatles obviously led the way to a certain extent after the first, you know, sort of the first way wave of the artists like Cliff Richard and Marty Wilde and all these different guys that come along, and they just took it and they really got serious about it, and that's where the competitiveness came between Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, all those guys, Jimmy Page. They were just driven.
Yeah.
And we just got on their coattails and went with it, you know.
And we thank the Brits so much for bringing the blues back, because it was just about dead in the United States, you know. All those artists were kind of forgotten. And the British brought it back, you know, and brought it back into the limelight, you know.
Well, we had great respect for the music that those guys had made and showed us, you know, what it took. I mean, a lot of it came from the attitude of the players, obviously, because they were mostly poor, from very humble backgrounds. And, you know, when you've got that behind you, you know, you play with a certain amount of emotion and feel that's hard to replicate, really. But I think we just did that, learned the basics, and then took it to another level in other ways. You know, it got louder, it got bigger. And by coming to America, which for us was like, oh my goodness, it was just such an eye-opener to come to America, where it was just like the land of the goodies, you know. Mm-hmm. Everything just was bigger and better and flashier and big cars. And everything. It was just, it blew my mind when I first came to New York. I was like, wow, this is just amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all aspired to break into America somehow, and that's really what drove us on. I mean, you know, we had to do it, and we did.
Now was Cochise, was that before Joker's Wild?
Yeah, Cochise, no, that was after.
That was after Joker's Wild. Okay.
We'd been living in Spain,
right,
Dave, and we were really poor, I must admit. We were pretty much struggling. We ended up living in Paris for over a year. We worked out of Paris,
mm-hmm,
pretty much the whole of France. We drove over and around, did shows and gigs with different people, like the Trogs and all kinds of people. And then Dave got the call about Pink Floyd, because
right,
they were friends of his. They'd kind of grown up. Some of them were from Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
And the lead player in the band, Sid Barrett, had, you know, completely overdone the drug thing with LSD and was in a really bad way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his mind was shot. He looked like he had two black holes in his head instead of eyes. Mm-hmm. It was just really horrible, because he was a very good looking guy.
Yeah.
And he had some amazing talent, but he'd lost the ability to actually do it. He just couldn't face an audience. So they sort of asked Dave if he would help them out,
mm-hmm,
while they were sort of in their sort of beginning stages doing shows and gigs around the country. And they had an album out, and they had a hit single, and gradually they just, you know, Dave became, took Sid's place, and they just didn't pick Sid up one day when he went out to a show. And I know it sounds kind of mean, but it's how it is sometimes,
right,
in the music business. It can be pretty hard.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Dave was the perfect replacement, and he just took the whole thing by the horns and just really, really got serious about what they had to do, because Roger Waters was a great writer,
mm-hmm,
but I wouldn't say he was the best musician, whereas
right,
Dave was way ahead from that, in that, you know, in that sort of area. He was a very fine musician already. He'd learned a lot, and we all had, by, you know, doing the gigs we'd done. But that's how Dave became part of Pink Floyd, with Rick Wright, Nick Mason, and Roger Waters. And the rest, as they say, you know, we all know is history, because
history,
it became
yeah,
bigger and bigger and bigger until Dark Side of the Moon, which was just
yep,
unbelievably big for them. And then The Wall. And I'm so proud of them for what they did,
mm-hmm,
because, you know, to see some of those shows, the production they put into it, and the thought, and all the things they put so much money back into the whole thing,
yep,
before they really, really made big money, and it paid off.
It sure did.
I mean, it still blows my mind, and I think watching those shows they did, that were just incredible.
Yeah. David did a fantastic job keeping the Pink Floyd name alive without Roger Waters, too. I mean, he,
uh-huh,
you know, all those albums he did as Pink Floyd was incredible. They're all
yeah,
awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, when we did the album, the first solo album together, he asked Willie and myself to help him out. And it was a lovely experience, because we went to the south of France to a studio called Super Bear,
right,
just outside Nice, to record. And we were there, I do, because you know he wanted to make a statement that he could make an album without the others, mm-hmm. and he really did. I think he did a really fine job. I love listening to that album. So some of the stuff on there, like I Can't Breathe, and you know, there's No Way Out of Here, things right. like that, are just really good songs.
That's probably one of my favorite albums of all time.
Oh, that's great to hear that, Ray. That really is. It's so rewarding, you know, years later when you look back on something you've done.
Yeah.
And I've done a lot of recording with different people. And it is just so nice. I mean, it's like when I look back from there, moving on from there to, like, when I joined Peter Frampton, mm-hmm. Mick Jones, I met when I was living in Paris back in '66.
Amazing.
He was there working with Johnny Halliday and Johnny Halliday's wife, Sylvie Vartan. And Mick was living the life because, I mean, Johnny Halliday was huge. He was like the Elvis Presley of France.
Right.
And Mick used to come and check us out at this club called the Bilbouquet in Paris. And he was really sweet because, you know, he had some money and he would sometimes take us out for a drink or whatever because he knew we didn't have very much, that's for sure. So it was, you know, that was the first time I really met Mick, and it's just so incredible that, you know, so years later in '79, I get the opportunity to audition for Foreigner, and in between that, Mick had come over to the UK and played on Peter's first solo album on a track called All I Wanna Be Is By Your Side, and it's a wonderful track if you listen to it, because it's played absolutely live in Island Studios in London, and it's one take done. And you know, Peter just literally showed us the chords when we walked in, and Mick was there. He was playing rhythm, and it just fell into place so perfectly with Mike Kelly on drums and Andy Bowne on keyboards. And that was one of my special sessions I think I've ever done, because Mick and I just looked at each other and went, "Wow, this is so cool." And you know, he remembered that when I auditioned for Foreigner.
Yeah.
Those years later, after they'd had two very successful albums, and that's how, well, I guess it came together. Really, I mean, Dennis Elliott, the drummer of Foreigner, kind of chose me, but Mick said, "Look, you know, we can't just make that decision so quickly, Dennis, because we've got a lot of bass players to go through, and there was a lot of people who wanted that job, believe me." And I was very, 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 very fortunate to be chosen to be part of that band, because it changed so many things in my life. I mean, from everything, from where I moved from the UK to America, I lived in New York, and I moved to upstate New York, and just traveled the world with the band, and we were on such a high, it was just fantastic.
Well, you know, Foreigner definitely will end up in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. There's no doubt. I mean,
well, you know, it's hard to understand or fathom why we're not there already.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's obviously some political reasons. I don't know what they are. I've never really looked into it or gone into it. But it would be nice to be recognized for what the band have achieved.
You'll get there.
They did achieve some really momentous things, especially when, you know, we did the 4 album, which is hard to believe, but next year is our 40th anniversary of the 4 album.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the number one album for 10 weeks, which is, I think, is the record for Atlantic Records to this day.
Yeah. That's a special album for me. I met my wife, and Waiting for a Girl Like You was playing. And that, it always reminds me of me.
It does.
People,
you know, because people got married using that song and all kinds of reasons. I mean, it's a beautiful song. I remember when Mick and Lou wrote it, because they called me up. It was a Sunday afternoon. I was living up in Westchester County, New York. And Mick had a home up there, too. And he said, "Why don't you come over? Lou and I are working on a new idea." He said, "I think you're going to like it." And I did. I went over to his house, and they played me the beginnings of Waiting for a Girl Like You.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, if that isn't the number one single, I don't know what is." Well, I was slightly out. It got to number two. And it was just, you know, I just knew it was a killer song. You know, it was just lovely.
Well, the other one that was really popular, kind of like that, was I Want to Know What Love Is, which...
Yeah, I mean, that was another special moment again.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, you know, Mick was gone very much towards sort of writing things on keyboards at that point, which I'm not sure if Lou was terribly happy with really, but it did change things for us. I mean, as big as those songs were, both those songs, Waiting for a Girl and Want to Know What Love Is, it changed our audience mm-hmm. to some degree. Instead of having a head-banging, you know, rock audience as we were used to because of all the rock tracks that we had done, we had some, shall we say, more middle-aged elderly people down in front. It was weird because I think they thought that's what we were like by then, but of course we would come out on stage and usually start with something like Feels Like the First Time, mm-hmm. going to Head Knocker and things like that, which were, you know, they're pretty heavy rock songs, and we weren't shy. I mean, we were up there, we were loud and proud. Yep. I mean, we could lay it down. It was a bit of a weird transition for us to go from the sort of rock band mm-hmm. that we had been into suddenly this sort of more, I don't know how you would call it, really. It was just sort of more sort of just a softer rock
soft
thing
rock.
To do.
Yeah.
The quality was there, but it changed the feel of the band somehow.
Sure. It's amazing though. It was relatively a small band for many years. You know, you had Lou, Mick, you, and Dennis, and that was it, right? Basically.
Yeah, well, what happened was I came into the band and started with Head Games,
right?
A Joy.
Right.
And the first track we actually cut at the old Atlantic Studios on Broadway in New York was Dirty White Boy,
mm-hmm.
which was just Mick, Dennis, and me, and Lou in the vocal booth laying the track down. That's how we worked. We used to always lay the tracks down with basically the four of us. And that worked really well. While Ian and Al would be in other rooms or other studios in that complex, but working on their parts to put on later, as it were. And we really liked working that way, and we did the album. The album came out, did really well, but not as well as we'd hoped. But I think that had something to do with the album cover, with the girl in the men's urinal. And some people took offense to that, and they didn't like it. So, we had a bit of a problem with that. It was a bit of a backlash. And after we toured that album for, a year, year and a half, we went all over the world practically with it. Mick and Lou sat down and, talked about the whole situation and decided that they wanted to carry on with just Dennis, myself, Lou, and Mick. And it was an awfully difficult decision to make mm-hmm. to ask Ian and Al to leave the band.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they had such great success up to that point, and it was really difficult to do, that's all I can say. I won't go into any more detail, but it hurt.
Yeah.
Hurt them, it hurt everybody. But we did it because we wanted to have the freedom to bring in other instruments and other instrumentalists, i.e. like Tom Dolby, who worked on the Four album with us, people like mm-hmm. that, Mark Rivera on saxophone. It gave us a freedom that we hadn't had before. And then when we went out on the road, we would have Mark and Bobby Mayo up behind us, the drums, with keyboards and saxophone and another guitar. It just gave us a more open approach to doing different songs, basically, and that's why it was done. And it worked. It really did work, because the Foreigner 4 album just took off, you know, from the first single, Urgent, into Waiting for a Girl Like You, and then on to Jukebox Hero, Nightlife, all those songs were just, you know, they were just on FM radio all the time, and they have been for 40 years now, I guess.
Yeah, they're endless. Endless hits. You know, they'll be around forever.
Very, very... I mean, I don't think any of us really realized it would last that long, but it has. Along with a lot of the other bands like Journey and, you know, mm-hmm. Led Zeppelin, Bad Company, you name them. I mean, they're there on the radio every day being played. So our music has lasted very, very, very well.
You know what I noticed on a lot of tracks? Ian Lloyd from The Stories does a lot of backup singing on a lot of tracks.
Yeah, Ian was a good friend of Mick's, and you know he was brought in just to really help, you know, sort of thicken up the background vocals when we used to work on them.
Right.
And Ian was good at arranging some of those parts too. And he's just a really nice guy to have around because he's a good vibe. He's fun, and we just all got on. It was like a family thing, really. And when we worked with really pushed us hard, pretty darn hard. It took us nearly a year to make that album. And some of the stuff that he pushed Lou to do, like with Jukebox Hero, I don't know. I mean, it was, I don't know how he got Lou to do it, because that's in the key of E. That's a high key. And it was, you know, it was tough, but it paid off in the end. I mean, Mick and Mutt butted heads quite a few times over different directions and things they wanted to do. But Mick, I will say, did win in the end.
Yeah, I think he did. Yeah, and Lou's such a nice guy. I interviewed Lou, and you know, we had a great conversation. And then, you know, he was talking, you know, of course, he talked about his surgery way back when and how sick he was and how he, you know, he was so fortunate to find that doctor of his.
It's a miracle.
It is.
I mean, he's been through such a lot.
Yeah.
It's you know, it's just terrible, really, what happened to him with the tumor and everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's still not fully, well, he's not, I mean, he's not that great in shape at the moment, to be honest. You know, we're all getting older, obviously.
I know.
I mean, Mick's had some heart problems.
Yeah.
Or one or two other things, you know, that, you know, he's dealing with as best he can, and we've all got to go through this from time to time.
Yep.
You know, I mean, I've just had a prostate thing done that I didn't know was going to happen until a few months ago when I was told there's a problem there, and we discussed it, and I said, look, you know, at my age, there's only one thing to do. I don't want to go for chemotherapy. I don't want radiation.
Yeah.
I've just had it removed, and, you know, I feel great now. I feel fine, but it was, you know, it's a big decision, and it was strange at first, but I feel fine now. You know, I feel back to normal. I just would love to get back out on the road.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it bothers me because there's so many people that are out and about not wearing a mask, and we can't have concerts, you know? I mean,
I just don't understand it.
Yeah, I don't get it either. Why can't we have shows?
I don't understand why people can't be more considerate to the fact that this thing is, you know, is this virus is serious, and it's killed 140,000 people in the U.S. alone so far. And I just heard, I listened to the UK radio station called Classic FM.
Uh-huh.
When I'm at home, and on the news there, they've got some very promising results from a vaccine they're working on at Oxford University.
Good.
And the first sort of batch of tests that over 1,000 people have proven to not only help people through this, but create antibodies as well. And it looks very promising that they can actually get over, you know, I don't know, 100 million doses out by probably later in the year, October maybe time,
right,
and start immunizing people to see if they can stop this spread, you know, across the world. And that's very encouraging to hear that, because people are really silly about going about what they call their normal life and just dismiss this thing, because you really have to be careful. I mean, I don't, my wife and I, we do not go into restaurants hardly ever now. We've been to a couple in the last few months, and we didn't feel comfortable. Luckily, my wife's a great cook, and she loves to cook at home. So we mainly, you know, where we live here, we live in a gated community, which feels safe. I don't mingle with other people unless I really, really have to.
Right,
you know, I always wear a mask all the time.
Me too. It's been rough not seeing the great. All my grandkids live here.
Yeah.
And I've got, we just have a new addition that makes number 5. For grandkids, so you know, it's been tough, you know. And now that the baby's here, you got to be careful around the baby, you know. So,
sure. Yeah. I mean, I've got how many grandchildren now? Five or six.
You're losing count.
There were two living in Miami with my son and his wife.
Uh-huh.
And I've got 3 in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter lives in the UK, still in Cambridge. And, you know, we don't see them very often because we can't.
I know.
And Miami's such a hot spot at the moment for this disease that, you know, that, I mean, we're just basically saying we can't take that risk, and we don't want to, because, you know, the last thing I want to do now, well, we've got this slight light at the end of the tunnel, but this vaccine being, you know, brought forward, that the last thing I want to do is get sick and have to quarantine for months or whatever.
Oh,
you know,
horrible.
I want to look forward to when we can start opening up safely and properly again.
I agree.
To do concerts and get back to some kind of normality. That's all we can hope for.
Yeah. It's just simple things, you know? Just to get out, go to the beach.
I'm not asking for the moon.
Yeah.
I'm just saying,
Exactly.
Treat each other with respect. That's what we need to do.
Exactly. Rick, I want to talk about a couple other bands. Cochise, I love that band, by the way. You know, I went on YouTube, and you got some great music there. Velvet Mountain. You got to explain that. It's an anthology. Explain that cover, man.
Well, B.J. Cole was a steel player, right?
Okay.
So it was like a country rock band.
Right.
Right, and we had a guy called Mick Grabham on guitar, who had been in a band that, well, he'd been in a band called Plastic Penny that had a one big hit in the UK.
Right.
And Mick and BJ together, they had like this idea for the band. Willie Wilson was on drums,
sure.
Myself on bass, and we had the first singer on the original album we did was, of course, Stuart Brand, then we got a guy called John Gilbert.
Mm-hmm.
And they came up with some really interesting ideas, like you say, like, you know, Velvet Mountain, and the band was good. I mean, it really was a good band, but we just didn't have the success that it maybe deserved, but we sure did get, funnily enough, later in life, a lot more sort of acknowledgement about how the band sounded and were. I mean, we were a good live band. We did some, you know, some really good shows in the UK. We never came to America with the band.
It's a shame,
but
you know.
It was a good experience. And the first Cochise album, I'm trying to think which album that was on. Was it on Swallowtails or what was it on? Can you remember?
Which one? Velvet Mountain?
Yeah.
I think it was, I'm not sure if it was Swallowtails or not.
Yeah, well, it might have been, but I can't remember. It's a long time ago now, back 69, 70. But, you know, it was unusual, I'd say that. And I enjoyed that time with the band. It was a good learning thing for me prior to, you know, at that time when Humble Pie had formed after the Small Faces collapse, when Steve left the band. And I'd been working with this guy called Jerry Shirley for a short time in Cambridge, who was the drummer of a band there called Little Women.
Yeah.
And Steve Marriott was, you know, he knew Jerry because he produced a single for it. Jerry was only 16 at the time. And Steve said to Peter Frampton, who was looking to form a new band because he didn't want to be known as the face of 68 any longer. He was a real pop star, Peter was at the time. And he said, I just got to get a band together, Steve, that gets respect for the playing, and, you know. And Steve said, yeah, I'll help you. He said, I'm going to recommend a couple of guys. One of them is this drummer, Jerry Shirley. You got to go check him out. Greg Ridley, the bass player for Spooky Tooth, who's a really great bass player, also a great guy. And they were getting it together. And then Steve literally walked out of the Small Faces and said, I want to join too. And that's how Humble Pie formed. And this was in like 69, they came out with their first album, with Natural Born Boogie as the, you know, the first single, which was a hit, you know, straight away in the UK. And it was it was like a super group with Steve Marriott, Peter Frampton, Greg Ridley, Jerry, who no one had ever heard of, but boy, was he a great drummer. I mean, he was amazing.
Some of the other tunes on Cochise, Why I Sing the Blues is an awesome track. To me, it sounds like Humble Pie and a little bit like Foghat in a way.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I got to know Steve by going to the sessions at Olympic Studios in London. And I asked him, I said, you know, would you mind coming to the studio one day with Jerry maybe and help us with some backing vocals? Well, what an experience that was, because we had to put Steve at the back of the room. He had such a loud voice. You know, you couldn't get him anywhere near the microphone because you wouldn't have been able to hear anybody else. He was just a power. I mean, he's like 5'4" of just pure energy.
I know.
He's an incredible guy. Yep. Some of the shows I saw them do in America as they got bigger and bigger, Steve was just such a dominating front man. He was amazing how he could hold an audience. I even watched him in Madison Square Garden, which just holds, 18,000 people, and he would be singing almost without the microphone near his mouth, and you could still hear him.
Yeah, he was incredible.
I'm so lucky to have ended up, when the Small Faces reformed, getting asked to do that by Steve. He rang me up one morning very early. He was in the studio. He said, I've just had an argument with Ronnie Lane. We need a bass player, Rick. Can you come to the studio? I said, but Steve, it's like 5 o'clock in the morning. I can't do that now. I'll come tomorrow, maybe. You know? So he said,
Steve Marriott was incredible. I never got to see Humble Pie, but I saw Steve Marriott's All Stars.
Yeah.
You know, he had Greg Ridley in the band, and I think Ian Wallace, Mickey Finn.
I mean, they were really powerful. I mean, they really were. They had some great tracks, and they did some great covers of songs, you know, like Walk on Gilded Splinters, and I Don't Need No Doctor, and all that sort of stuff. I mean, for me, one of the best live albums ever was Rockin' the Fillmore.
Oh, yeah.
They did.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's the best.
It's an absolutely brilliant album.
I agree with you 100%. Yeah, I Don't Need No Doctor's a classic. I mean, that's, you know, when you talk rock and roll, that's it. That's the song right there.
That's where it's at.
That's where it's
at. That's the real deal.
Yeah, that's the real deal. What, you guys kind of rocked out on Cochise, too, with Love's Made a Fool of You, that cover.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we could rock.
Yeah.
I mean, we knew what we could do, but we were just going through that sort of next phase, sort of up the ladder, as it were, before, you know, I mean, I guess really when after Cochise and I joined up with Peter, that was my first kind of break, because what had happened was, before that, I joined these guys called Parrish and Gervais, Paul Gervais and Brian Parrish, who were being produced by George Martin, the Beatles producer.
Sure.
And they, you know, they had some really good songs, but they didn't really have a lot of direction. So they said, look, we're going to do a tour of Canada and the US. This was the beginning of 73, I think it was. It may have been 72. And we started out in Toronto. We played about 2 weeks there in a club on the main drag through Toronto. And then we came down to New York, and we were doing small clubs down in the village and stuff. We did a few more gigs around the country, nothing really special. But when we came back, the core of the band was Mike Kelly on drums from Spooky Tooth,
right.
Mickey Gallagher on keyboards, and myself. And Peter knew me by then, and I'd been doing sessions for him on his solo album. He said, would you, you know, be interested in forming a band with me and, you know, coming to America, because I'm still with Dee Anthony, Humble Pie's manager, and we've got to start from the bottom again and work our way up. And that's exactly what we did. We came over and started opening shows for Jay Giles, Foghat, Edgar Winter, you name it. I mean, we just worked and worked and worked. I did 13 tours of America in 2.5 years.
Wow.
You know, that was a lot of work. I mean, I wasn't home too much. And my wife wasn't terribly happy about that. But, you know, you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
That's the way it works with musicians and touring in a band.
Yeah.
I think I've been backwards and forwards across the pond, as they call it. A good few times.
You paid your dues.
I think I should get a gold star for that.
Exactly. Well, you joined Peter Frampton, I think, with the album Wind of Change, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I started doing sessions for that. He was in Olympic Studios, and he had friends like Ringo Starr, Klaus Voormann, Andy Bound, myself, Mike Kelly,
Billy Preston.
A good bunch of people that would come in and cut different tracks. The first track I cut, I think, was Plain Shame, which I really enjoyed, because that was a good rock track. You know, and the first song we ever wrote together was Do You Feel Like We Do? You know, never realizing that one day it would turn into this monster live song. You know, it was the showcase song, really, of the whole set was Do You Feel Like We Do? It just got bigger and bigger, and I'm very proud to have my name attached to that, that song.
Then Frampton's Camel, you guys actually recorded at Electric Ladyland, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
With Eddie Kramer, Jimmy Hendrix's producer, lovely guy, English guy, Eddie.
Uh-huh.
And we had a lot of fun. I mean, you know, the English, we loved to make fun of each other and, you know, take the mickey out of one another. And we did that relentlessly on that album. And Electric Ladies, I mean, it's a tremendous studio. Mm-hmm. That's where we did the 4-on-4 album as well, by the way.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. When we did the Frampton's Camel album there, we did it in the small studio, number 2 at the back of the studios, but for 4-on-4, we used the main studio at the front, which we were there, I should say, for a year. We practically lived there for a year.
Wow.
Down good old HD. I don't think it's still there anymore. I'm not sure.
Huh.
I also recorded a Bad Company live album there too. Mm. You know, what is it? What you hear is what you get.
Right.
I mean, I can't remember if that's what the title is. That was with Brian Howe on vocals, who recently passed, unfortunately.
Yeah. And you co-wrote Doobie Wah, right?
Yes. Yeah, well, that was really a nod to to the Doobie Brothers, really. That was the whole vibe about that.
Really?
We did quite a lot of shows with the Doobies out on the West Coast for Bill Graham.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I mean, they were such a nice bunch of guys.
Yeah.
Couldn't wish to meet nicer people than the Doobie Brothers. And also, they were a great band.
Mm-hmm.
We did a lot of shows with Poco as well.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, I mean, they were just so good. Their harmonies were wonderful. And Timothy Schmidt, their bass player, of course, now is the Eagles bass player. Perfect fit. An absolute perfect fit.
Well, there's more bands. There's Bad Company.
I mean, one of the bands I've got to say I got to play with was Lynyrd Skynyrd. I mean, when I was in Bad Company, we did an awful lot of shows together because they liked us and we liked them. And so when Leon got, well, he, you know, he used to like a drink or two, shall we say, and it got a little bit out of hand, and he would occasionally fall off the stage or something or another. So that Joe Boyle and their manager called me up and said, Rick, would you be so able or capable of just coming and fitting in if Leon goes, you know, too far over the edge, as it were? I said, Joe, I said, just give me a set list and I'll learn as best as I could. Well, but two or three days later, he rang me again and said, we want you to come now. Leon's really, he's got to go into rehab. So that's what happened. So I was kind of learning the stuff, listening to it on the plane as I was going over to Denver to join up with them. And that was, a fantastic experience, but it wasn't perfect for me, shall I say. Because the way their whole way of playing is different to what I'm kind of used to.
Right.
I could play the songs, but I couldn't play it with the same feel that they had. And Leon had learned to play the bass because he was involved in the plane crash that they had been in earlier on in their career. He'd had his hands set in such a way that he played up and down the neck of the bass and always had his bass sort of upright. I don't know if you've ever seen them play, but that's how he used to play. And they wanted me to exactly copy what Leon had done, and I just couldn't do it. It wasn't the way I played the bass. So I think we lasted about 8 weeks. I did 8 weeks with them, and it was great fun. I mean, we really did have a blast, and I got to meet lots of really nice people. All the guys in the band were terrific. And then it just came to a point where they knew and I knew that it wasn't really a good fit.
Right.
And that I should really go home and go on to something else, which is what I did, you know. But, you know, for the time being, I'm very proud to say I'm the only English guy who ever played with Lynyrd Skynyrd, as far as I know.
I just had Artemis Pyle on the show not long ago.
He's a character.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy.
And he was in the plane crash, too. He's a guy that, you know, knocked on the door and got help, you know, and pulled people out of the plane. And, you know, we were talking about the movie he's got out now, you know. Survivors, you know. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that was a tragedy there.
Well,
but
sure was.
You know, they got through it.
Yeah.
And came out the other side.
Yeah.
I think, you know, going through anything like that is going to damage you somewhere or another.
Oh, yeah. You don't forget.
They really did tear it up for a good few years on the road, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But they survived, you know. I mean, there's not many of them left, unfortunately.
No, there isn't.
I think Gary Rossington's probably the only original left that I know of.
Well, I had Ed King on the show. He just passed away recently, but he's a guy.
Well, Ed wrote Sweet Home Alabama.
He sure did. Yeah, he was a great. And, you know, he was in the Strawberry Alarm Clock back in the
That's
early
right.
60s.
Yeah. He used to frighten us to death sometimes. We were getting an elevator with Ed, and, you know, he used to like a drink or two, shall we say. And he would just pull a gun on you, you know.
Really?
Just for fun. And that wasn't funny.
Oh, man.
I remember that a couple of times. He just said, I don't like you English limeys. You know?
Really?
Oh, boy. Yeah, he did that a few times.
Oh, man.
He was kind of crazy, Ed.
Rick, this is going to be a great book, and let me tell you.
Well, we're working on it. My son writes beautifully. He really does.
Good.
He uses my stories, and he just writes them in such a way that they just seem to mean more somehow. What we usually do, he just gets me... a couple of glasses of wine. He said, right, tell me a story. Tell me about this. Tell me about that. And he doesn't. He just writes it all down. So we're just gradually going through the process of just... I mean, some of the things I remember very well and some not so well, because, you know, it's such a lot has happened in my life in those 50 years of playing. So it's we're working on getting it so it makes sense, so that it's got some humour, and it's interesting more than anything. You know, I just want people to know that I've enjoyed every minute of being in rock and roll.
I can't wait. I got to ask you, Lou Gramm told me a story. I don't know if you were with the band at that time, but they stopped at a 7-Eleven, and then they drove 4 hours away, and they left Mick at the 7-Eleven because they thought he was in his bunk because the curtains were closed, and they didn't know he had left. And he had a call.
I don't think I was with him when that happened. I don't remember that.
It was so funny.
It may have been after we, you know, sort of all left the band, because when Lou decided to do a solo album and then go solo, as it were, we brought in a new singer called Johnny Edwards
right.
for Unusual Heat. But Dennis didn't feel that it was the right, you know, it just didn't feel the right chemistry, basically.
Right.
And Dennis said, I'm going to leave. And I just didn't want to go on without Dennis, because he was my,
yeah.
you know, he was my man.
I was
with the rhythm section. And I love the way Dennis Elliott plays drums.
Yep.
So I said, you know, I think I'm going to call it a day too. And I said to me, I just think we've gone as far as we can at the moment. And I think maybe we should all take a break from this. You know, and that's when I called up Simon Kirk and Mick Rouse and said, are you guys going out on tour this year with Bad Company? Mm-hmm. He said, yeah, September. I said, can I join you guys? He said, yeah. He said, because we're not very happy with the guy we've got at the moment.
Yeah.
I said, that'd be fantastic. So I literally walked out the door of Foreigner and into the door of Bad Company in 92.
That's crazy.
And we did a 3.5 month tour of North America.
Mm.
All the way up to Christmas, and then I came down to Florida for my first time to Siesta Key with Mick Rouse and stayed at the Golf and Bay Club, and that's how I got to know this area and now live here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said Mick Rouse? Did Mick Rouse live here?
Yeah, he had a place on the Golf and Bay Club.
Oh, I didn't know that. Huh.
Yeah, he did. He had it there for a long time. In fact, he used to come down here a lot. And yeah, that's when I got aware of all the intercoastal, this whole area. I just started looking around, and I said to my wife, I said, when I get to 70, we're going to settle up in the UK, and we're going to move to Florida, because I've had enough of this grey winters, miserable mornings, you know, cold, damp. She said, yep, I think we deserve it. So I said, that's what we'll do. So we came here, we kind of stayed in hotels and looked around, saw loads and loads of homes, and then found a place down here south of Sarasota. We're loving it. It is a little too hot in the summer, I have to say, but we can get by.
Yeah. I found Sarasota. I did a fantasy camp with the Orioles, because I was really into baseball as a kid.
Uh-huh.
So I played baseball with the Orioles, and it was like a fantasy camp, like they have for fantasy rock and roll.
Yeah.
And that was in Sarasota. It was here, and that's how I said, man, this is a nice looking place, you know.
Lovely. I mean, I love the thing about Sarasota. It's got, you know, it's got kind of a European feel somehow to a downtown.
Yes.
But you've got theaters, you've got the opera, you've got everything. You've got Ringling Brothers. You've got all these really nice things, and you know the gardens.
Mm-hmm.
I just like the area a lot. I really do. It's not like living in Tampa or somewhere like that.
Right.
It's different.
It is different.
You know, because I live just south of Sarasota, it's kind of slightly more rural down here. And, you know, our house looks out on a big lake. We've got lovely wildlife. Mm-hmm. One or two alligators at times, but that's okay. You learn to live with them. And, you know, it's just a nice laid back place to live. I like that a lot.
Yeah, we got a few rockers here.
I know.
Yeah, Dickie,
you know,
Betts.
Brian Johnson, but ACDC lives over on Berkey.
Yep.
You know, Dickie Betts lives real close to me.
Yep.
He crossed on Spanish Point. So, yeah, I know there's a few people around. But we all keep ourselves to ourselves pretty much.
I know. You know, it's funny. All the guys I interview, they always want to know how the other guys I'm interviewing are doing, because they don't talk.
Yeah, I know, it's weird.
They were in the band together.
We're on the road together.
We're
in each other's pockets all the time, hanging out at a bar or wherever.
Yeah.
Eating together, whatever. Because, the current Foreigner lineup is just a great bunch of guys.
Right.
I love them all. I mean, Bruce Watson, Michael Bluestein,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, he's the closest thing to Lou Grant ever. Vocally, I mean, he really is. And, I love playing with the guys. I mean, we just enjoy each other's company.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You had the 40th anniversary? That was the big reunion thing?
Yeah, we did that. I'm up in, where were we? I'm trying to think. So it's a casino called Soaring Eagle.
Okay.
We did that. That's up in Michigan.
All right.
And that was just so much fun, getting all the original guys back together. And, you know, again, we did one or two other things. We did Sturgis, the motorcycle show out in South Dakota.
Oh, that's got to be cool.
Things like that. But
yeah.
I don't think it's not perfect for everyone. I mean, Dennis, I don't think he enjoys traveling very much anymore.
Right.
He's happy to be down in Florida on his boat. Mm-hmm. Lou, because of his health issues, it's not so easy for him to do anymore. And so, you know, at the moment, really, it's either Ian McDonald, Al Greenwood, myself, and me, who will make appearances as and when we can.
Right.
And it's just a fun thing to do. As I said, this year we started out beginning of March. I flew up to Iowa, to Davenport. I did a show there with the guys, with Al. Mick wasn't there on that one. And then we drove, Al and I like to drive, and we drove over to Milwaukee. We did a show there at the Riverside Theater. The next day we were all sent home. That was it. It's over, you know, because of COVID. So it's a bummer, because for the people I feel most for is our crew and the people that work for the band. They've all been furloughed. They've all been laid off. Yes, they're getting unemployment money and stuff like that, but for them, their life is being on the road with the band.
Right, right.
You know, they're not used to being home in the summertime.
You know, I read
they're climbing the walls.
I know. We're all climbing the walls.
Yeah, we all are.
I read on Wikipedia that you did a show in Sarasota with Dennis Elliott and Foreigner. Is that true?
Yeah, we played at the Van Weasel.
Oh, at the Van Weasel. Really? Okay.
Yeah, that was back in, I think it was 2015.
I missed that show for some reason.
Yeah, well, what happened was we had booked a holiday.
Right.
My wife and I did stay in the Golden Bay Club for a couple of weeks.
Right.
And I hadn't even looked at the itinerary, what the guys were doing. And then I said, oh, gee, they're playing Sarasota. I said, while we're here. So I called up Phil Carlson, the manager of the band.
Uh-huh.
I said, Phil, I'm going to be in Jester Key. Can I come to the show? He said, come, silly. Of course, Dennis is coming up. Mick's going to be there. We'd love to have you. So I said, you're on. We're coming. So we did. You know, we just turned up, and Kelly introduced us. The place went nuts because they love to see the originals turn up. And I think we did Hot Blooded. I think we did I Want to Know What Love Is, a couple of other songs, and it just felt really good to do it together. And I hadn't seen Dennis then for years, or Mick for that matter, for a good long while.
I'm so sorry I missed that one.
A really nice catch up evening of chatting and stories and one or two glasses of wine. Well, Mick doesn't drink these days; he's given up. But Dennis and I still enjoy a glass.
Oh yeah. And, of course, this area is known for its wine. I mean, everybody drinks wine here.
Well, we recently turned onto a store called Trader Joe's. I'm sure
sure.
And they have really, we love French rosé wine. They have the best selection there. And at a reasonable price, I might add. So we love Trader Joe's. It's one of our favorite stores. We shop there at least once or twice a week, I'd say. So we like that. And Total Wine, of course, we also like that place.
Yeah, that's a great place. Wonderful place. And they deliver.
Oh, yeah. They sure do.
All right, Rick, you got to tell me about, you told me earlier you had a Keith Emerson story.
Keith Emerson?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, I thought, didn't you get locked in a bathroom or something? I thought it was Keith Emerson, no?
No, not that I know of.
Oh, okay.
I've never met Keith, so I know.
I thought it was a Keith Emerson story. Okay, never mind.
No, I remember, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, obviously. Because I always remember when I first saw them, they started their show with the classical music piece, the Common Man.
Right.
And I thought, how pretentious is this? I couldn't believe it. But I actually really like Greg Lake as a bass player, because he was in King Crimson with Ian.
Yeah.
And I thought Keith Emerson was a fantastic keyboard player and all this stuff. something he used to do with the daggers in the keyboard. But I never liked Carl Palmer's drumming. I've always thought he overplayed too much. He never really laid the beat down. He never sort of played one on, like four on four, like Dennis does. And I was one person I didn't, I never really got that band, Emerson, Lake and Palmer. It's just too, I don't know. Too weird for me.
You know who had the Keith Emerson story? That was Rick Wakeman. He told me to.
I'm going to see it. He would have known.
Yeah, he told me next time we talk, he'll tell me about it.
The great, greats of all time. With all the stuff he's done with Yes and all the capes he wore and all that. He's a very flamboyant guy.
He is. He's a nice guy. Very funny. Very funny guy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he does radio shows himself and stuff. And he is. He's very good.
Well, he was on a TV show in the UK, Grumpy Old Men.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's perfect for him. Absolutely perfect. Grumpy old man.
Rick, here's your final question. I ask everybody this question, and I get some interesting answers. If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie, to perform, collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be? Now, it's tough for you because you played with just about everybody, but...
Well, I have to say, if I saw Paul McCartney walk out of the Corn, I would probably faint. I've met Paul a good few times now. He's the most lovely guy.
Uh-huh.
But when I'm in his presence, I just can't help but look at him and go, but you're a Beatle. You're a Beatle, man. You know?
That's funny.
I've got to know George Harrison. I've worked, you know, done some things with Ringo. And
really,
I never met John Lennon. That's the only one I didn't meet.
Yeah.
But there's something about Paul that I just find he's just super special. I just think he's wonderful what he's achieved. And just seeing him live, you know, I remember when he did Wings. I went to see him at the Hammersmith Odeon in London, and he was doing the... I can't remember the song that it started with, but it made the hair stand up on on my neck. He's just got that magic about him. I just love him.
And he's a bass player.
So there you go.
Paul McCartney, I get that a lot.
Yeah, well, he's great. He really is. He deserves all the accolades. He's very special.
So what's next for Rick?
Well, all I can say is, as I say, I am working with my son on the book.
Okay.
And I'm also trying to come up with one or two ideas for songs.
Mm-hmm.
And just keeping in touch with everybody in the band. And this news about this vaccine in England is very exciting for me at the moment, because I want people to go back to doing things in a safe and, you know, sensible way, so that we can all get back to doing concerts again, so that people can get out of their houses and go and have a good time.
You know, I've done more interviews now than ever because everybody's at home and
they haven't got anywhere else to go.
I know. They want to talk, you know. They want to get back into
the building. It's hardly... One of my favorite little places, dives and bars around here, is Mad Mo's, which is real near where I live.
Uh-huh.
And we used to go in there, you know, 2-3 times a week just to hang, have lunch or something.
Sure.
We got to know all the waitresses and waiters there. And they were the most lovely people. But this COVID has just stopped it because it's just taking a risk. And, you know, the band has insurance on us all because we're somewhat sort of precious, so they say. And they don't want us doing that. They really don't.
Yeah.
You know, we just don't want you getting sick. Please take care. So we have to.
Exactly. Well, Rick, thank you so much, man, for being on the show today. We'll keep in touch. As soon as this gets better and things clear up, I'd like to invite you. My wife and I would like to invite you and your wife to dinner around here.
That'd be fantastic. You know, well, I've got your number.
Yep.
So we'll keep in touch. And as I say, when things are sensible, we'll do that. And I'd love to, you know, spend an evening chatting.
That'd be wonderful.
Having a nice meal together somewhere safe.
Okay, Rick. Thank you so much, man. I appreciate it.
You're so welcome. It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Ray.
Me too. Bye-bye now.
Bye now. Bye-bye.
Very special thanks to Rick Wills for arranging this interview and the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of BBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. It is real news, people. And you can go to Rick Wills' fan page. Let me see if I can read this. It's a long address here. www.facebook.com/groups/ And there's a 1-3-1-6-0-4-7-8-8-5-1-8-5-2-8-2. We'll definitely post that on my website. But if you go ahead and Google Rick Wills fan page on Facebook, I'm sure it'll come right up. My new book is finally out, entitled The Rockstar Chronicles, Series 1. It chronicles truths, confessions, and wisdom from the music legends that set us all free. Order yours today on hardcover or ebook at bookbaby.com. Features over 45 intimate conversations with some of the greatest rock legends the world will ever know. And it features the hardcover, which is a collector's edition. This is series one, and I'll probably put out about four. Thank you for listening. Have a great week. Stay safe. God bless you, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends. Brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com. Specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio, Station 1.